This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents Backblast, written by Mark Greaney, narrated by Jay Snyder. Why seekest thou vengeance, O man? With what purpose is it that thou pursuest it? Thinkest thou to pain thine adversary by it? Know that thou thyself feelest its greatest torments. Akhenaten, Egyptian Pharaoh. Three can keep a secret, if two of them are dead. Benjamin Franklin. Prologue. The host of the garden party accidentally left his phone in the kitchen, so when it all went to hell, he was the last to know. Seconds before the debacle, he stood on the patio with his wife, chatting with guests over the music from a four-piece jazz ensemble set up by the pool. It was late evening and too cold for an outdoor event like this, but the host and his wife had erected a dozen flaming gas heaters, and enough red wine had been consumed to warm the blood of everyone in attendance. Denny Carmichael was in his 60s, but lean and tan, with a deeply lined but razor-sharp face and a formidable bearing. One of his wife's friends had once confided in her by saying he looked like Abraham Lincoln's evil twin. Denny and his wife traded gossip with a couple who lived in D.C., but weekended in nearby Easton, Maryland. Denny was wholly uninterested in the petty chit-chat, but his wife lived for this shit, so he stood there and faked it, swigging Pinot Noir that did little to ameliorate his boredom. While his guests droned on about the cost of their neighborhood's new swimming pool, Denny looked around his property, regarded the Italianate patio, the opulent saltwater pool, and the meticulously maintained lawn sprinkled with their well-heeled friends. Eleanor liked to flee D.C. and drive out here to their estate in rural Maryland every week or two. It was expensive as hell, but his wife came from money, and this was what she wanted. Denny thought of this place as his wife's house, and these friends were hers as well. Carmichael didn't do friendships. He barely did marriage, for that matter. He lived for his work, and while everyone around him partied, he would much rather have been back at the office. The jazz band finished a sedate rendition of Sentimental Journey to polite applause, but before the four-piece could fire up their next song, heads began turning toward several sets of headlights racing up the driveway. Denny watched the lights approach, his already dark mood quickly blackening full-on to anger. Three black Yukon XL SUVs parked on the grass alongside the driveway, 50 feet from the patio. All in attendance knew government motor pool vehicles when they saw them, because this patch of Maryland was only 25 miles from D.C., and most everyone here worked in the district. Carmichael felt around in his jacket and realized he'd left his phone inside. He'd missed an important call, he had no doubt. He placed his wine glass on a cafe table next to him, made a quick apology to the couple standing nearby, kissed a perturbed Eleanor, and then started towards the driveway. A dozen men in suits climbed out of the vehicles, and the gray veins in Carmichael's forehead throbbed. The guests were not supposed to see these security officers, because they didn't know what Denny really did for a living. None of his wife's friends knew he was the director of the National Clandestine Service, which made him the top spy at CIA. The rage he felt over his protection detail alarming the guests was blunted by the fact he knew these men wouldn't be spun up like this without one hell of a good reason. Every security officer on Carmichael's detail knew their boss would tear their head off for overreacting to a threat. So Denny took this show of force to mean something serious was going down. "Talk," he demanded while he was still strides away from the armed men. The team leader was a 41-year-old former army major named Dorenzi, who was just like his protectee, all business, all the time.
"Sorry, sir, you didn't answer your phone. Orders are to cordon you off from the guests and hand you my mobile so you can take a call from the office."
Five men moved between Carmichael and the stunned party guests, and squat P-90 bullpup submachine guns came out of their coats, held at low ready by men with intense, searching eyes. Every one of the guests, the band, the caterers, even Denny's own wife, stared, mouths agape, at this spectacle. Most in attendance knew Carmichael had served as an officer in the Marine Corps, but all thought he now worked in something banal at the Department of Homeland Security, as that was his official story. Denny ignored the attention and asked no more questions of Dorenzi. He only mumbled an explanation that he'd left his phone in the kitchen. Dorenzi responded with,
"The office is sending air."
To this, Carmichael cocked his head.
"Air? Jesus Christ."
He thought over the outrageous spectacle of a helicopter landing in the yard and whisking him away.
"Are we at war?" "Don't know, boss."
Dorenzi was muscle. He had no answers. Instead, he handed his phone to his protectee and led him briskly towards the house. Carmichael snatched it and held it to his ear while he walked.
"Who is this?"
"It's Mays."
Jordan Mays was Carmichael's number two at NCS. He was a dozen years younger than his boss, but Carmichael could barely recall a time when Mays was not by his side.
"Talk. He's here." "Who's here?"
A brief delay from Mays. Then one word.
"Gentry."
Carmichael stopped in his tracks. After a few seconds, he spoke again, but his voice cracked.
Here? Here where?
"Worst case scenario, he's got eyes on you right now."
Carmichael looked around the lawn. In an instant, his emotion cycled from fury through confusion and then straight on to terror, and his voice went hoarse.
"He's in the goddamn States?"
"Best intel puts him in your state, Denny."
Carmichael spoke quickly now. There would be no more pregnant pauses.
"Get me the fuck out of here!"
He began walking briskly, still cordoned off from the rest by Dorenzi and his men.
"Helo inbound, ETA 5 mics.
As he hurried along, Denny scanned his property. The tree line of pines in the distance, half covered by thick mist, suddenly appeared foreboding. Carmichael barked into the phone.
5 mics, my ass! Expedite it!"
Chapter 1. The band started back up tentatively, but the revelers' attention was firmly fixed on the dozen serious men in the driveway surrounding the host. Carmichael's eyes searched from left to right, locking on human forms, because everyone at the party was a threat now. A congressman from Nevada, a prosecutor from Virginia, a horse breeder from Kentucky, the co-owner of a fashion magazine on Fifth Avenue, caterers, musicians, and an event organizer standing by the pool with his hands on his hips, gaping at the armed Neanderthals, destroying the mood of this glorious spring garden social. Carmichael double-checked everyone's faces as he neared the back door, and the men and women he did not recognize, there were just a few, he triple-checked. He knew Gentry's appearance. He'd been thinking about it for years. But he also knew the man could disguise himself better than anyone he'd ever known. When he was inside and completely surrounded by his detail, he stood there a moment, breathing heavily. He remembered he was still holding the phone to his ear. He said,
"We're sure?"
Mays replied in a clipped, efficient tone.
"Israelis tracked him to a freighter that embarked from Lisbon 8 days ago. It's now anchored in the Chesapeake Bay, just west of Easton. He might be heading west into D.C., but if he goes east, that's less than 15 minutes from you by car. We've sent a Marine fast team to hit the boat, but..."
"Gentry won't be on it."
"Not a chance. He would have slipped off the second he got near the shore. Have to clear it anyway. Might find some clues on board as to what his play is here in the States."
"Where did the Israelis come across this intel?"
"Unknown. I have a conference call set up with Menachem Auerbach at Mossad. We'll initiate it as soon as you get to Langley."
Just then, Carmichael saw heads turn to the south. Seconds later, he heard the thumping. He knew the sound. It was one of the agency's sleek new Eurocopters. Jordan Mays added,
"Denny, sorry about the party. I know it was important to Eleanor."
"Fuck this party. I want the Violator working group assembled in 60 mics, everyone."
"Roger that."
The landing of the helo and the exfiltration of the host of the garden party went down in a fashion just as obnoxious as Carmichael feared it might. He'd spend the rest of his life explaining this moment away to his wife's friends, but the fallout wasn't even on his radar now. As he boarded the aircraft, along with Dorenzi and 3 other bodyguards, his mind reverted into combat mode. Carmichael had fought as a lieutenant in Vietnam, as a lieutenant colonel in Lebanon and Grenada, and as a CIA officer against the Russians in Afghanistan. He'd halo jumped into Panama, jetted into the Balkans, dune buggied into Iraq, and helicoptered back into Afghanistan 20 years after his first visit. Denny knew combat, and he knew how to push everything extraneous out of his mind, leaving it solely committed to the utter simplicity of kill or be killed. This was his mindset now. The helo took off towards the south, leaving the party behind as it rose over misty, rolling farmland. The pilot pushed the cyclic forward and then twisted the throttle to pick up speed in the cold air. Carmichael ordered Mays to hold the line. Then he moved to a seat just behind the flight crew and put on a set of headphones. Pulling the microphone down over his lips, he tapped the pilot on his shoulder. The man turned back to him.
"Yes, sir?" "You have countermeasures on board?"
The pilot seemed surprised by the question. He glanced to his co-pilot, then back to the windscreen in front of him.
"Yes, sir. Chaff and flares."
Denny said,
"Be prepared to employ them. I want your head on a swivel."
The co-pilot spoke up, unsure.
"We were rushed into this, anything you can tell us about what we're up against would be helpful."
Denny shrugged. He said,
"The threat is an ex-asset, codename Violator, a former agency paramilitary officer with one hell of a grudge."
The pilot spun his head back around 60 degrees and stared through his visor at the much older man.
"One guy? All this is about one guy?"
Denny's leathery face turned even harder as he looked back into the pilot's visor.
"Son, do I look like I scare easily?"
"Not at all."
"Well, this son of a bitch scares me to death. Turn around and fly this thing to Langley, and be ready for inbound missiles."
"Sir,"
he said with a slight nod, and then he focused fully on the flight. 20 seconds later, Carmichael was back on the phone with his number two.
"Get my family out of town. Have them taken to the ranch in Provo. If Violator is here for me, I want them out of the way, so I can do what I need to."
The helo began swaying to the left and right, not quite in jerking movements, but certainly nausea-inducing to those in back. Dorenzi moved forward and sat down next to Carmichael. He had his own intercom-ready headset on. He tapped the pilot on his back, but the man did not turn around. The security officer asked,
"Why the hell are we flying like this?"
Carmichael answered for the pilot, who was fully occupied with his work.
"We have to operate under the assumption that Gentry has a SAM, or at least an RPG. We'll stay low to counter the SAM threat, but we need to fly like this over population centers to counter an RPG."
Dorenzi then asked,
"Why do you think Gentry has a SAM or an RPG?
Carmichael looked out the window, focusing on the twinkling lights of the DC suburbs below him.
"Because he's the fucking Gray Man."
Chapter 2. A dimly lit street in the center of Washington Highlands was a hell of a place for a nighttime stroll. The Highlands were in the southeastern corner of the district, over the Anacostia River in Ward 8, full of high-rise government housing, low-income apartment complexes, and derelict single-family homes on tiny lots strewn with garbage. Ward 8 had been the second most dangerous ward in the district, behind Ward 7, but it had recently retaken the lead thanks to a triple murder in the last week of the reporting period. But despite the late hour and the area's infamous reputation, a lone pedestrian ambled calmly through the misty evening, heading north on Atlantic Street southeast, as if he didn't have a care in the world. He walked along a broken sidewalk, catching the glow of most all of the street lamps that had not been shot out or burned out and left black by a city that didn't give a damn about its poorest residents. He wore blue jeans and a wrinkled blue blazer. His dark brown hair was tousled and damp, and a clean-shaven face revealed him as white, which, around here, at this time of night, meant he was probably up to no good. It was 10 p.m., and the neighborhood appeared devoid of any life other than the solo pedestrian. But while the street itself was barren, several sets of eyes tracked the man's movements. Astonished senior citizens looked out from behind their barred apartment windows. A single mother up with a sick kid watched through the bolted plexiglass door of her duplex unit with a wince of regret, knowing good and well the damn fool in the street was going to get rolled at best and murdered at worst. And a teen with a cell phone on a darkened stoop of an apartment building watched the man carefully, reporting what he saw to an acquaintance at the other end of the connection, with hopes of collecting a finder's fee if his friend showed up with a crew and beat every last item of value off of the hapless outsider. But the teen and his friend were out of luck, because another group of predators were closer, and they also had their eyes on this target of opportunity. Three dark silhouettes watched the white man from where they stood in a driveway, in front of a 55-gallon drum filled with burning trash. Marvin was the oldest of the three, and at 31, he had 11 priors, most for BND or armed robbery. Only two arrests had really stuck, the first one earning him 11 months, 29 days in a city lockup. And then, on the inside, Marvin had bought himself a full dime at Hagerstown for manslaughter. He did 6 years before being released on good behavior, a relative term in prison, and now he was back on the streets. And he wasn't looking for work. He was looking for a score. In this pursuit, he had taken on the two young men with him. Darius and James were both 16, and they looked up to the older Marvin since he'd done time and he'd killed a man. And because of this, they would follow him anywhere. For Marvin's part, he liked running a crew of kids because they could take chances. Any convictions they earned would likely be expunged on their 18th birthdays. Marvin carried a handgun in his waistband under his baggy boxers. It was a rusty Lorcan Arms L380, a piece of junk, even compared to the other pot metal pistols ubiquitous on the low end of crime here in the gun-free zone of D.C. He'd never shot the weapon. It was for show, really, which meant he kept the grip of the gun on display, sticking out from below his faux leather jacket, but only when the cops weren't around. If he saw a patrol car, a couple of shakes would drop the little automatic down the inside of his warm-up pants and out onto the ground. He could then kick it away or under something, or else he could just fucking run. Marvin had been running from trouble since long before the two boys standing with him were born. The two kids had thin switchblades they'd shoplifted from a head shop in Hyattsville. The knives were comically cheap novelty items, but the boys didn't know any better, and they thought themselves impossibly badass for carrying them inside their jackets. Darius and James fingered their knives under their clothes as they watched the white man disappear in the mist, just past an overgrown hedge strewn with blown trash. As one, they turned to each other, smiling in surprise at this evening's outrageous fortune. The pedestrian seemed oblivious to the fact he'd just walked past the three men standing by the fire, which made them think the fool was drunk, high, or perhaps a combination of both. Even though they rarely saw whites walking around this section of Washington Highlands at night, men and women of all races certainly drove into this neighborhood to buy drugs all the time, especially at night, and the two boys couldn't imagine any reason for this fool's presence other than a buy. That meant he either had cash or drugs, and it didn't matter which, because around here, drugs were cash. Darius and James looked back over the flames coming out of the oil drum towards their leader. Marvin nodded back to his crew, giving them the prompting they needed. All three left the warmth of the drum and headed down the driveway to the sidewalk, following the white man with their hands hovering inches from the weapons they kept tucked inside their clothes. At the same instant three hunters were stalking their prey on 8th Street Southeast, a $24 million Eurocopter streaked high over D.C., flying from Maryland in the northeast and heading towards Virginia in the southwest. The men on board discussed the chances someone below them was lining up the advanced optical sights of a man-portable surface-to-air missile on the tail rotor behind them, or perhaps tracking the nose of the Hilo with the iron sights of a rocket-propelled grenade launcher. Onboard countermeasures were ready. The pilot made defensive maneuvers, and all eyes were focused outside the Hilo and down at street level, scanning for the bright flare of a missile launch. But there was no flare, and there was no launch, because although the man they feared was in fact somewhere below them, he had no SAM, nor did he have an RPG. He didn't even have a pistol, or for that matter, any cash. Court Gentry walked alone through D.C.'s most dangerous district, as aware of the footsteps closing on him as he was of the throbbing in his right forearm and the maddening itch under the plaster cast that went from his elbow to his wrist. He knew three men were following him, a definite leader and two subordinates, much younger and completely subservient to their boss. Gentry determined all this from a quarter-second half-glance as he passed them on the driveway, as well as from the sounds of their footfalls. The man in the middle was more sure, the men on either side uneasy, slowing from time to time, then rushing to catch back up to the one in charge. Court knew something about the psychology of crime. These street thugs weren't looking for a fight, they were looking for a victim. The strength of the attacker's resolve would be reflected in how quickly they acted. If they messed around and followed him for blocks, then they would probably never go through with it. On the other hand, if they challenged him right now, that meant their confidence was high, and they wouldn't be expecting any resistance, and this would indicate to Gentry they were probably armed, and they'd done this sort of thing before. Just then, still half a block from the next intersection, the man in the middle of the three called out,
"Yo! You know what this is! You don't gotta get hurt!"
Court was pleased this guy was getting right to it. After all, he didn't have all night. He stopped, but he did not turn around. He just stood there, facing away. The three men behind came closer.
"Turn around, motherfucker! Do it slow!"
Court took a few calming breaths, but he did not turn.
"Yo, bitch, I'm talking to you!"
Now Court slowly pivoted to face the threat. The three attackers stood only 6 feet away on the sidewalk. Court scanned their eyes. It was always the same in a threat situation. Determine the will and determine the skill. He pegged the leader as cocky, amped up from excitement, but not from concern. The other two tried to show confidence, but their furtive eyes sold them out. All three clutched weapons. The leader had a small gunmetal blue pistol, and the two men with him, actually now to Court they appeared to be teenagers, each held up a knife. Court spoke calmly.
"Evening, gents."
The leader cocked his head in surprise. After a second, the thin black man said,
"I want that wallet, and that phone."
He looked around on the street, then asked,
"Where your car at?"
Court ignored the man's voice and focused on the pistol in his hand.
"What do you have there?"
"It's a gun, motherfucker."
"Right. What kind of gun?"
"The kind of gun that's gonna pop a cap in your eyes if you don't pull out that wallet and drop it off real nice and slow."
The man raised the pistol to eye level, in Court's face now. Even though the light was bad, Court was able to identify the weapon quickly here, just 3 feet from the tip of his nose. He sighed, disappointed.
"An L380? What the hell am I supposed to do with that piece of shit?"
The armed man stiffened his gun arm, then smiled.
"Oh, I got it. You trying to die tonight?"
Court looked around at the two others.
"Any chance you kids are strapped?"
The boys glanced at their boss, confused. After a second, they held their knives up higher.
"I didn't think so."
Court looked up into the wet sky with a half-smile.
"Just my luck."
Chapter 3 Marvin had been pointing guns at people since before his 13th birthday, and in all this time he'd never seen anyone so utterly unimpressed. Normally, eyes widened to saucers and fixed on the muzzle of his weapon, and no matter what he did for the rest of the encounter, the person at gunpoint never, ever glanced away from the instrument in his hand. They rarely even blinked. But this guy turned to the other men, looked around at the street, into the sky, and at the windows of the duplexes all around. He didn't seem at all concerned that there was a motherfucking gat in his motherfucking face. The white man didn't look high, and he didn't smell drunk. His languid eyes were clear. His relaxed body did not sway. For some reason, he just didn't give a damn. And this infuriated Marvin. He had no plan B for intimidating a victim. The two boys stepped to either side of their prey. Now Marvin had a pistol pointed to the man's forehead, and his crew had stilettos in range on the left and right. But the white man wasn't worried about the knives either. He just sighed more deeply now. his shoulders slumped all the way down.
Any chance I can persuade you guys to step off? I don't have any cash, no phone, no car. I don't have a thing to offer you but trouble, and I promise you, I'm a lot more trouble than I'm worth. What do you say we call it a night, and...
Marvin was tired of this asshole. He stepped forward a half step, raising the gun higher to drive his point home. As he did so, the white man's left hand shot up and forward, and he spun on his left foot in a blur, pirouetting his body out of the line of fire. Marvin was stunned by the movement. As the man turned, his strong hand locked onto the slide of the pistol just aft of the muzzle, and he shoved the weapon to the side and down. Marvin instinctively pulled the trigger. The Lorcan cracked loud in the empty street, but the white man had both rotated his body away to Marvin's right and pushed the gun down low to Marvin's left just as it fired. Marvin realized instantly he had missed. James leapt into the air. The stiletto dropped to the ground as he grabbed at his lower leg with both hands. He fell into the grass by the sidewalk and wailed. The kid had taken the .380 hollow point round through the top of his foot. Marvin knew he had fucked up, but he still had the gun in his hand, and for some inexplicable reason, his intended victim released his hold of the weapon. The man turned away from Marvin now, his attention on Darius and his blade, leaving his back exposed, just a couple of feet from Marvin's gun. Marvin couldn't believe this fool could be so stupid as to let go of a loaded gun and then turn his back on it. Marvin raised the weapon and pointed it at the back of the fool's head, ready to kill the man before he did anything to Darius. He pulled the trigger. Click. Court ignored the asshole with the gun behind him because he knew the man was out of the fight for the next few seconds. By grabbing the slide of the weapon, Court had kept it from cycling after it fired. Now there was a spent shell inside the chamber of the Lorcan, and the dude behind him could pull that trigger all damn day and it wouldn't go bang. Not until he racked the slide to eject the spent casing and load a fresh round from the magazine. And Court didn't think for an instant he would figure this out for at least a couple of seconds. The attacker was in a fight for his life. His adrenaline would make him spastic and unable to process the flood of information coming his way. Court had learned long ago that in any gunfight, one does not rise to the occasion. Instead, one defaults to the level of ability he has mastered. And the asshole with the shitty pistol couldn't have mastered much of anything involving firearms, otherwise he wouldn't be carrying such a shitty pistol. Now Court had time to deal with the stiletto in front of him. The kid jabbed straight out with it, lunging his body with the strike, and Court raised his right arm. The blade stuck into the plaster cast on his forearm, and Court used his left hand to catch the boy's knife hand in a wrist lock, twisting until the knife dropped away. Court continued the backwards twist of the hand, then pushed against the sinews connecting the boy's upper arm and lower arm together. He wrenched it back at a 45-degree angle, cranking the arm awkwardly away from the bend of the elbow joint, spraining the tendons before the boy figured out his only defense to the move was to fall back onto the pavement on his back. He did this. Then he rolled around on the cold concrete, clutching an elbow that jolted with pain. Court figured the man behind him would be in the middle of troubleshooting his situation, so he turned back to him. The thin man had his hand on the top of the pistol, and he had just begun racking the slide. The spent casing ejected into the air, but before the slide sprang forward, Court's left hand shot out again and wrapped around the exposed barrel and the frame, restricting the slide's progress forward. Court's thumb pressed on the mag release button now, dropping the magazine full of bullets to the sidewalk. Court let go of the gun. Marvin retained his grip on the weapon, with his finger on the trigger. Before he understood what was happening, he squeezed the trigger, and the striker fired on the empty chamber. The gun went click again. Marvin looked up at the white man, his own eyes as wide as saucers now. His victim looked back at him, still calm, almost bored. Marvin gaped at his empty pistol and at the magazine on the ground. He did not understand what had just happened, but he was pretty sure his weapon was useless. He had a folding knife in his back pocket, but he wasn't thinking about it now. In fact, he wouldn't remember it until much later. For now, his mind panicked. He turned and ran. Marvin had been running for his whole life, after all. and he left his teenaged crew behind. Court watched the thin man race off into the mist. Then he knelt down over the two injured boys. The teen holding his battered arm was sitting up on the sidewalk, but the kid with the hole in his foot still writhed in pain on the grass. Their weapons were somewhere in the dark, out of reach. Court scanned the buildings in all directions, the windows and doorways and driveways he could see through the mist, and while he did so he spoke softly.
"Hell of a guy, your fearless leader."
Neither boy replied. They just both stared in horror at the calm man kneeling over them. Court waited for some response, but when nothing came, he shrugged.
"How much cash you carrying?"
They looked to each other briefly, then back up. Court sniffed.
"How about that? I'm mugging you. The irony, right?"
Court reached out, felt through the clothing worn by the kid with the hole in his foot, and pulled a $10 bill out of his front pocket. The boy with the wounded arm extended a shaking hand holding a wad of crumpled $1 bills, and Court stuffed them into the pocket of his jeans. He then grabbed the first boy's injured foot and looked at the bloody hole in the top of his white tennis shoe. In a soft voice, he said,
"That looks worse than it is, so maybe you shouldn't look at it."
He turned to the kid with the twisted arm and helped him back up to his feet.
"You're okay. That will hurt for a few days, tops. Less if you ice it. It's your job to help him. Take him to a hospital. When you get there, tell the cops some dickhead was playing with his gun and it went off. They'll hassle you, but if you stick with your story, eventually they'll buy it and move on."
Both boys nodded slowly. Then, both Court's face and his voice darkened.
"But if you tell them about me, give them a description, any information at all, I'll come back here. I'll find out whatever it is in this world that you love. And I will kill it. Are we clear?"
The boys nodded again, much faster this time.
"Good night."
The standing boy hefted the wounded boy, and together they hobbled off into the evening. Gentry noticed they went in a different direction from their boss, and he took that as a positive sign. But he also noted no one had come out of any of the homes nearby to investigate the gunshot, and this depressed him a little. Court had been away from the United States for 5 years. It occurred to him now that this America didn't feel much different than some of the more dangerous third world countries he'd operated in. He'd always thought of the U.S. as home, as a sanctuary, as his safe place. But that was fantasy. He knew the truth was just the opposite. This was Indian country. He was a wanted man here. There existed danger and menace at every turn. After a moment, Court Gentry walked on, bundling his jacket around him to ward off the cold fog. Chapter 4. CIA headquarters in Langley, an unincorporated neighborhood in the city of McLean, Virginia, was open 24 hours a day, but the executive offices on the 7th floor of the old headquarters building were normally deathly quiet at 10 p.m. on a Saturday night. This evening, however, lights began flashing back on just before 10, and by 10:30, an entire office suite was occupied by nearly 24 executives, assistants, communications specialists, and other support staff. The Eurocopter from Maryland landed in the parking lot minutes later, and Jordan Mays was there waiting for it in front of the large amphitheater known as The Bubble, shielding his white hair from a light rainfall with a plastic file folder. Denny Carmichael climbed out of the aircraft, surrounded by his 4 security men, but Dorenzi and company soon took up positions just behind their charge, so Mays could shoulder up to his boss while they all walked for the safety of the old headquarters building. As soon as they were inside and Mays could be heard over the helicopter, he updated his superior.
"Here's where we stand. Fast team reports no joy on board the cargo ship, but they found a bedroll and some personal items in a recess aft of the engine room. They definitely had a stowaway on board."
"How did he get off?"
"A supply launch left the boat 2 minutes before the Marines boarded. Figured Gentry was on it."
Denny knew he wouldn't catch Gentry sound asleep in his cot.
"He's in the wind.
Who do you have assembled here? The JSOC liaison, the NSA liaison, the NGA liaison, the DS&T guy redded on Violator, and the communications officer on the task force. We'll have 8 in the meeting in total.
Denny kept walking, but said,
There are only 7 in the Violator working group. I've asked Suzanne Brewer of Programs and Plans to join us.
The 2 CIA execs and Dorenzi all had their IDs scanned, and then they entered the elevator, leaving 3 of the bodyguards behind. Carmichael's clipped voice showed his displeasure.
What does Brewer have to do with this?
Among her other duties, she has been red-selling a lone wolf attack on domestic CIA infrastructure for over a year. She's got the background of a good targeting officer, and she knows how to prevent an attack by a determined enemy. If Gentry is here, and if he's got CIA in his sights, Suzanne might prove useful.
She doesn't know a damn thing about the problem at hand. Gentry isn't some raghead with an AK taking potshots at cars at the South Gate, for God's sake.
Brewer is as sharp a counter-terror mind as we have. She's spent a decade on risk mitigation involving agency facilities and personnel overseas, and she's developed protocols for dealing with sophisticated homegrown terror hazards as well as high-level foreign actors who might target agency assets.
I don't like bringing outsiders into the fold.
Think about it, Denny. We're going to have to beef up your security protocols, and we'll be putting assets on Gentry's known associates in the city. There is no way that can happen without Brewer learning about it. She's an outsider now, but we bring her in and give her password access to the working group, and she'll become an ally instead of an impediment.
And when she learns we don't want Gentry alive?
Mays didn't hesitate.
Operational expediences won't trouble her. If you tell her this target needs to die, she'll make it happen.
The elevator arrived on the 7th floor. Mays reached out and took Denny by the arm before he left the car. He spoke softly to him.
I was also thinking, if Gentry is here to target the agency, and this manages to make some noise outside of the agency, God forbid, we might want to frame this to the media as some kind of an external threat. If Suzanne is involved beefing up the guns and gates of our facilities, it will only help us sell it as some lone wolf terror attack on the agency.
Denny looked at his second in command. In a louder voice, he said,
1. This is a terror attack on the agency. Gentry didn't come all this way to pick up an old paycheck. And 2. Keeping this shit in-house is paramount. No one breathes a word. We'll take care of it.
Carmichael took off, heading up a brightly lit hallway towards his office. Mays knew when to fight with his boss, and he knew when to let his boss wrestle with his own arguments. As he caught up with Carmichael, he said,
So, Suzanne, yay or nay?
After a moment, the director of National Clandestine Service gave in, to a point.
Maybe. But before I bring her into the program, I want to know more about her.
She's reliable. I've worked with her myself. She'll play ball.
Denny slowed and turned back towards Mays, but before he could say anything, Mays preempted him by handing over the plastic file folder.
Here's her 2-page write-up. You want more? I can send it to your office.
Carmichael took the file, but said,
I want it all. Nobody gets redded on Violator unless I know them inside and out.
10 minutes later, 5 men and 1 woman converged in a glass-walled conference room that could easily accommodate 16, took their seats quickly, and then all eyes turned to a pair of side-by-side monitors on the wall. A satellite link-up had been established with Tel Aviv and fed to one of the monitors, but until the Kamo people on the Israeli side of the connection gave the word that their attendee was on camera and ready, the screen just glowed blue. Next to this, a larger screen displayed an interactive map of the greater Washington, D.C. area. The responsibilities of those in the room represented some of the most secret departments and divisions within the CIA. Communications was there, as were the CIA employees charged with working with the National Security Agency, the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, and the Joint Special Operations Command, the military's most elite paramilitary fighting force. A CIA analyst sat across from a senior officer in the Department of Science and Technology. Jordan Mays, assistant director of the National Clandestine Service, entered and sat to the left of the empty chair at the head of the table. Most of these officers had been on the Violator Working Group for years. It had taken them, both physically and virtually, to locations all over the world. But this was most assuredly the first time any of them found the need to refer to a map of the local area in relation to the gentry hunt. The one new face in the room was also the lone female. Suzanne Brewer was a 39-year-old programs and plans officer for the National Clandestine Service. She spent her days at CIA identifying and fortifying soft spots in agency security protocols. She knew the name of every potential agent provocateur. She knew the details of threats against CIA personnel. Every known operation targeting the CIA, every website that posted warnings to life and limb of intelligence officers all over the district. She wasn't a spy herself, but she saw it as her mission to keep the spies of NCS safe from harm. Denny Carmichael marched in at 11:45 p.m., his brow pinched with purpose. Dorenzi was with him, and as Denny moved to his chair, his close protection officer took a position against the wall, present for the meeting in an observer capacity only. It was his job to keep his protectee safe from harm, after all. Denny dropped into his seat at the head of the conference table, facing the large monitors on the opposite wall. He turned first to Brewer.
"Suzanne, you're the odd man out here, if you will excuse the phrase. This is going to be a little out of your wheelhouse, but A.D. Mays invited you in. Before I decide whether you are going to have code word access to the working group, I need to make a determination about your relevance to all this. What have you been told?"
"Only that there is a potential threat to local CIA personnel, and I would be briefed in the meeting and asked for my preliminary assessment."
"I've read your file," Carmichael said. "You've been solid in delicate situations. You've worked as a targeting officer as well as a counter-terror officer, and you've excelled in both positions."
"Thank you, sir."
"But you haven't run up against a situation as difficult or as delicate as this," Brewer said.
"I only ask for an opportunity to show you what I can do."
Carmichael turned to Mays, and with a nod, gave him the go-ahead to brief her. Mays said,
"Here's the sit rep. A former Ground Branch paramilitary operations officer, codenamed Violator, has appeared suddenly in the United States. We think it's likely he's in the immediate area."
Brewer was confused.
"And this former employee, he poses some sort of a threat?"
Mays just said,
"His name is Cortland Gentry."
It was obvious to all that the name meant something to Suzanne Brewer. She blinked hard.
"The Gray Man? You're talking about the Gray Man? Here?"
The reply was delivered in a biting tone.
"We call him Violator, Suzanne. You aren't at the water cooler with the junior administrators."
Chastened, she said,
"Of course, I'm sorry. But why is he a threat? My understanding was that we were after him."
Mays said,
"We are, and he knows it. 5 years now. That's why him showing up like this is so problematic. It's possible his arrival in the area was coincidence, a waypoint towards his final destination. But we have to allow for the possibility that he is here on some sort of an offensive operation,"
Mays added.
"It's what he does, after all."
Brewer spoke with a tone of astonishment.
That would be suicide on his part."
On the monitor next to the map, a new image appeared, a passport photo of Cortland Gentry, wearing a blue blazer and wire-rimmed glasses. The image was at least 5 years old. Brewer said,
"He looks so average."
Carmichael broke into the conversation.
"Do you know what this ex-asset is capable of?"
"I admit I only know the rumors, cafeteria chatter and such. That file has been SCI code word classified,"
she said, and then quickly added,
"which of course you know because you classified it."
"I did," replied Carmichael.
She added,
"If I am to help you, I'll need to know what we're dealing with. The more information you can give me, the better."
Jordan Mays said,
"Here's what you need to know. The threat is one man, but the threat is real.
Gentry was, hands down, the best hard asset in the entire agency while he was in.
And how long was he in?
He was with us for nearly 12 years.
Ex-military?
Negative. His potential was identified at a young age. Then he was brought into a pilot program designed to train exceptional young men for autonomous fieldwork.
She lifted her pen and put the tip on the legal pad in front of her. She still seemed stunned by the thought of going up against the gray man, but she was quickly composing herself and getting down to work.
The name of this program?
When no one spoke, Brewer glanced up from her pad. The room was perfectly silent, and all eyes stared at the pen on the paper. After a few seconds, she slowly put the pen back down.
I see.
Mays broke the silence.
After 9/11, Violator was folded into a rendition and direct action task force in Ground Branch.
Brewer said,
I'm cleared for SAD ops. Will you tell me the task force's name?
Carmichael answered with a wave of his hand, as if it didn't matter.
Gulf Sierra, run by Matthew Hanley.
Brewer just muttered.
The Goon Squad.
So you've heard of them, too?
Well, like it is with Gentry, I only know the legend. They were supposedly the best we had.
Brewer glanced quickly around the room. It was evident to all she was wondering why on earth Gentry's former superior was not present. Matthew Hanley was now the head of the Special Activities Division. Surely he was cleared for anything said in this room. As she was about to bring up this concern, something else occurred to her.
I guess the most important thing you can tell me is why we are after Gentry in the first place.
She looked to Mays, but Mays only turned his head to Carmichael. Apparently, Carmichael would determine if she was to be allowed to know this part of the story. Before Carmichael could speak, a disembodied voice filled the room.
We have Director Arbach ready on the satellite.
Mays told the commo technician to send the feed to the monitor. The large blue screen on the wall came to life. Menachem Auerbach sat at a desk wearing an open-collared white button-down. The man was 72 years old, and he had a thick neck and a thicker gut, but he also was in possession of a ruddy complexion and a coiffed black mane that was only peppered with strands of silver. His visage was tired and sullen, but Carmichael expected nothing else, because as long as he'd known the Mossad man, Auerbach had always looked as if he'd just been awakened from a deep sleep and told that his dog had died. Carmichael and Auerbach had first met in a bomb shelter in Beirut in 1985, both intelligence officers representing their countries during Lebanon's insane 17-faction civil war. Denny was new at the CIA at the time, but he'd already spent over a decade in military intelligence, so he and the rugged Mossad officer worked well together in those instances when CIA and Mossad found themselves in close operational relationships. Carmichael and Auerbach had kept the relationship up in the 90s, and then, after 9/11, they worked even more closely together. Carmichael became station chief in Hong Kong, then was promoted to head the CIA's Special Activities Division, a hard-charging unit of paramilitary officers that was called on constantly during the War on Terror. After several years running SAD, he was promoted again, this time to run the entire National Clandestine Service. As high up on the American intelligence food chain as Carmichael was, Menachem Auerbach had reached even loftier realms in the Mossad, becoming the head of Israeli intelligence several years earlier. Denny hadn't spoken to Auerbach in months, and that meant this would normally be the time for pleasantries about health and family, but Carmichael wasn't in a pleasant mood.
What do you know, Manny?
Auerbach spoke in a voice graveled by 6 decades of smoking.
I know that we owe you an apology. We had access to your man, Gentry, but we let him slip between our fingers, and it appears he has escaped into your area of operations.
Carmichael responded.
The imprecision in your words is a concern. First off, Gentry isn't my man. He's my target. And D.C. isn't my A.O. It's my damn home. CIA doesn't run ops here.
Auerbach raised an eyebrow, an act that looked like it took a significant amount of his low energy.
I imagine that will change immediately in light of what I am about to tell you. Talk. As you know, Mr. Gentry recently saved the life of our Prime Minister, an inconsequential thing to me, really, as I don't have a high regard for politicians. But one of my top people was appreciative, and he single-handedly arranged for Mr. Gentry's escape from Europe. We only found out about this today. It goes without saying that I have detained my officer for further questioning. How did Gentry get out of Europe? Via container ship leaving out of the Portuguese city of Aveiro. We tracked the boat, but by the time we began looking for it, it was already in your Chesapeake Bay. Of course we reached out to your office instantly, but we suspect Mr. Gentry would have had time to make his way off the ship and on to shore.
Carmichael took his time controlling his fury. Then he said,
I take it your man was unaware of Gentry's importance? He'd been told Mr. Gentry was wanted by the CIA. He'd been warned the man was both formidable and an enemy to both of our nations. And that's it?
At the conference table, several people looked at one another in confusion. Jordan Mays, on the other hand, seemed unfazed by the back and forth between the two veteran spies. Auerbach said,
He did not know specifics of Gentry's crimes.
Carmichael rubbed his eyes under his glasses and leaned back in his chair.
Well, Manny, you've handed me one hell of a shit sandwich, haven't you? I'm not exactly sure how you can help me from over there, other than to shake down that traitor of yours and glean any scrap of intel you can get.
If Auerbach did not like the characterization of his subordinate, he gave no hint of it on his face, but he replied,
My officer is no traitor to his country. He rewarded the man who prevented the decapitation of our government. Having said that, I will question him personally to find out everything he knows, after giving him some days in solitary detention to soften him up. I hope you are thorough.
Auerbach's tired face tightened a bit.
Mossad doesn't need any tips on interrogation from CIA. I'll let you know what I find out.
Auerbach leaned a little closer to the camera.
In the meantime, I suggest you lock your doors tonight. I've read the after-action reports regarding the swath of destruction this former asset of yours burned through Europe last month. He is quite the talented killing machine. I would not want him mad at me.
Auerbach leaned back with a smile and reached for a button on the desk console in front of him.
My love to Eleanor.
He punched the button and the feed went dead. Carmichael paid no attention to the others in the conference room. Instead, he exhaled, looking off into space.
Fucking Manny.
One of the analysts at the table interrupted his thought.
Director Carmichael, apologies for pointing this out if it's sensitive, but it seems clear Auerbach knows more about why we are hunting this target than I do. What does Violator have to do with Israel?
Carmichael answered in an offhanded manner.
Gentry was involved in an op while working in SAD. Israel came out on the short end of things. Manny knows about it. You do not.
He shrugged.
Not relevant to your operation.
The analyst said, It might help us understand why he went to such lengths to protect the Israeli Prime Minister. That doesn't fit with what we know about the man.
George, no.
There was an annoyed finality in Carmichael's voice. George just held up a hand in surrender. Brewer took this all in. She was fascinated to see other working group members asking questions about Violator. They were tasked with catching him, but their need to know apparently didn't include details of his former operations. Carmichael turned to Brewer now, surprising her with the speed of the movement.
Okay, Suzanne. Time to earn yourself a seat at the table. You've heard what we're up against. What do you suggest we do?
Brewer looked around, and her voice became unsure.
I don't see any outside entities represented here.
Outside entities?
Protocol for something like this, local threat, I mean, is to bring in the FBI.
Carmichael sighed, disappointed in her comment.
No bureau. This isn't going to be a DOJ dog and pony show. We have one man in the area. We can handle this. What steps do you say we take first?
She said, Honestly, if this were Paris, Buenos Aires, even Toronto, we would have more options from an operational standpoint. But D.C. isn't our turf. I can't just send a security team in a helicopter over the Capitol and a surveillance team in a van down Pennsylvania Avenue.
Carmichael shook his head. There are counterintelligence protocols for resources at our disposal. On an ad hoc basis, I can bring in various assets. I can order up contracted security with TS clearance. I can call in JSOC operators.
Brewer was astonished. JSOC operators? You're talking about Delta Force?
Mays corrected her. They haven't been called that for years, but yeah, special mission units. Those guys.
To run a direct action mission in the United States?
Yes, Carmichael replied flatly.
Brewer was realizing Carmichael had been right when he said she'd never worked on an operation of this magnitude.
You would need approval from the director, who himself would need approval from the president.
I have approval from the director, who has an existing understanding with POTUS involving Violator. He smiled. Welcome to the big leagues, Brewer. You want in this program. You're going to have to get with the program.
Suzanne Brewer composed herself for a moment, well aware that all eyes were on her. Then she reached out and touched the intercom button. Mays and Carmichael exchanged a look, surprised that the subordinate was taking such liberties. She was the most junior officer in the room, but clearly she was no shrinking violet. A communications specialist answered on the intercom.
Kamo? Where are we in accessing local police, D.C. Metro, and civilian camera networks?
We'll be up on all systems by tomorrow at 7 a.m.
And facial recog?
Ready to go. Once we have the feeds, we'll get to work. It'll be a slow process, a lot of cameras for the computers to look at.
I understand. Are we monitoring first responder bands?
Do it. Police, ambulance, fire. We need to be on the lookout for anything anomalous in the district involving a single subject fitting his description. If he's a lone wolf, he might steal a car, break into a building, rob a pawn shop in the burbs. Hell, if he's been on a cargo ship for that long, he might hire a hooker or get himself busted in a massage parlor.
We'll get on it immediately.
The room was quiet. Then Carmichael looked to Mays.
All right. I'm sold. Suzanne is in the working group, in charge of the Tactical Operations Center. She runs defense, and she is subordinate to you on offense. She sees primary intel on Violator, beginning with everything we know about his actions in the past 2 years.
Brewer cocked her head.
You said he's been on the run for 5 years.
Carmichael stared her down.
You get 2 years. That is plenty of background for you to build a profile of his modus operandi.
Suzanne Brewer let it go.
Thank you, sir.
Carmichael addressed the entire table now.
Listen up. Violator has been running from us for a long time. Suddenly, he's right back here in our midst. This gives rise to the possibility he has transitioned from defender to aggressor. That should be extremely disconcerting to you all.
He pointed a finger at the map.
The quicker we can find him out there, the better. The longer he's free on the streets, the more time he has to set up an operation to go on the attack.
He shook his head.
We are not going to give him that time.
Chapter 5 Court Gentry stood in the darkness, a light rain falling on his head and shoulders, the back of his jacket soaked from leaning against the steps of a rusted playground slide. He shifted his feet back and forth for warmth and blew into his hands. As he stood and shivered in the tiny park, he watched a young white man in a red parka standing on the porch of a dilapidated single-story home across the street. The man lit a cigarette and looked around in all directions, his eyes searching for anyone watching him. Court was just 100 feet away, but he might as well have been invisible. The man looked through him and continued his scan. Then he left the porch and headed down the street. Court kept his eyes on the man until he disappeared around the corner a block to the south. When he was out of view, Court turned his attention back to the house. Sandwiched between a pair of low-rent and low-rise apartment buildings, it had whitewashed wood-clappered walls and a small front porch, accented by a black metal door that looked like it